Namaste, good morning, everyone. I received an email with a few questions in it from one person. And the last question, which I'd like to bring up now, is that there have been so many people unkind to me in my life that it is natural for me to be unkind to others. Why shouldn't I be unkind to others, rather? You see, one could call this the default setting of the ego based on its conditioning. The default conditioning is to give back. Tit for tat. You are unkind to me, therefore I will be unkind to you. You versus me and me versus you. Now, if the sense of doership is pulled out from this dynamic, you did this to me, therefore I shall do the same to you. When that is pulled out from the equation, and one just sees it in an objective light, then it could happen, the thought could arise that I know how it feels when someone is unkind to me. It doesn't feel nice. And therefore, all the more reason I should be careful not to be unkind to others, because I know precisely how it feels. And then one finds that one starts getting out of the action-reaction loop. The action-reaction loop based on doership. Now, certainly, it does not mean that I keep quiet and let the world be unkind to me. I say what I have to say. I reply what I feel like replying. But this time, the personal sting of doership is not there in my reply. This transformation, mostly gradual, becomes a new way of seeing relationships, the resurrection to a new dimension of living. Last time on the talk at Mahashivratri, I had spoken about Joel Goldsmith's teachings, which are so close in spirit to Advaita. You see, his main concept was give up this belief in two powers, good and evil. If God is the only power, all powerful, all pervading, all knowing, there is no power apart from God. Give up this belief in two powers means there is nothing apart from God to fight. If God is all-pervading, there is nothing that is not God. And that is why Rameshji would tell seekers who came to see him that if we believe in the concept of good and evil, God and the devil, then the question must arise, who created the devil? And therefore, all there is the source from which duality of every conceivable kind has emerged. So as Joel Goldsmith says, when we give up this belief in two powers, we accept God's will. We accept whatever arises in the moment in consciousness. Thereafter, we do what we think and feel we should do. But this initial battle with what is, this constant holding a sword up to fight what is what produces stress and anxiety. And that is why Jesus tells Pilate, "You have no power over me unless it is given to you from the above." If it is God's will. So our battle with life, you see, our battle based on conditioning, the conditioning of survival, I must survive, me and my precious body must survive and not die. Protecting what's dear to me, my thoughts, my feelings, my emotions, my judgments, and so on and so forth. I must defend them because the world is against what I am and what I stand for. I'm going to read out a couple of sentences of Joel Goldsmith. This is from the book, his book, Practicing the Presence. We must think seriously on this subject of protection, because each day we are faced with suggestions of impending or threatened danger. Always some person, some place, or something is being presented as a destructive force which we fear, or from which we seek a God to save us. God's allness makes it utterly impossible for any destructive or evil influence to exist anywhere, in heaven, on earth, or in hell. You see, that's precisely the point. On one side, we know God is all there is. There is nothing which cannot be God. But in daily living, we think there are forces which are not God and which are against us. But if we accept that all there is consciousness, which includes duality of every conceivable kind, we accept the nature of daily living. Sometimes pleasure, sometimes pain, and every other opposite. We go with the flow. And so we find that this wild swing of the pendulum, which is going from one polaric end to the other, happy and sad, when we accept the two ends of the same stick, our pendulum starts swinging less and less and less. When there is pain, it is not overlaid with a psychological story which creates suffering beyond the physical pain. And when there is pleasure, we enjoy the pleasure while it lasts, but knowing that the nature of pleasure is transient, we are no longer addicted and attached to it like we were. And so we find that we are being brought to a position of equilibrium, a stillness. When we give up this belief in two powers, we find that our thinking mind, which was running all over the place, starts subsiding, starts accepting, resting. And when that happens, or even when that starts happening, one is now more and more available to the present moment and what it offers. Present to what is. The acceptance of what is. So that is what wisdom teachings help bring about. The thinking mind that is operating in horizontal time, past, future, polaric ends. And when consciousness through grace reduces this activity and brings in the dimension of vertical time, out of this game of the thinking mind, the vertical time in the now, which is as the Rosicrucians in one of their symbols represent by putting a white rose at the center point of the cross, is the only moment there ever is. The rest is a story. Me and my story. So any teaching, any path that appeals to you, if it is bringing you to that peace of the present moment, then you know that is, it is impacting your experience. But if you find that you are getting more and more lost in concepts, in experiences, and so on and so forth, then perhaps you need to relook at it. And your relationship to it. On the same theme, Joel Goldsmith says, God alone is power. God is one. One power, one life, one love, one spirit, one cause, one being, one source. Nothing comes into our experience unless it comes from God. The next time something that we call evil comes into our experience, let us remember our principle and turn around and say, that too is from God. And he goes on to say, to practice this principle, hour after hour, day in and day out, holding to God as the law of our being, God as the activity of our day, changes our entire experience. At first, this is all in the realm of the mind, but by constant practice, it leaves the realm of the mind and comes down into the heart. into the awareness, into consciousness, and then it takes over and lives our experience. You see, the mind and the heart are not two separate physical objects. What it is pointing at is, at first, it appeals to the mind. The mind has to remember, recall this new way of operating, so to speak, because it has understood, it has grasped, but it has not become a living experience. That sometimes takes time. So living from the heart means when it becomes a natural experience of living. The heart, as Goldsmith says, of awareness, of consciousness. You see, I speak on another YouTube channel quite often on the teachings of Shirdi Sai Baba. It's called Sai Baba's Devotee Speaks. And there I often get asked this. You know, if someone has lost a job or lost a loved one or needs something, and then the question is, I pray to Sai Baba, but he is not giving me what I ask for, and so on and so forth. So if we accept, in this case, Shirdi Sai Baba or any master we follow, God, the source, being a representative of that, do we really need to ask? Wouldn't the source know not only what we need, but what is good for us? So that is separation itself. The game of separation has already begun by us thinking that we need to ask for certain things because God may not know. And then what we ask for, we don't know whether it will be good for us. How do we know? But if we accept in totality that what happens is His will, He knows best, then there is no scope for separation. Then we are truly instruments of the divine. So we stop making these demands on God. Lastly, when we realize that our life is unfolding from within our own being, we come to the realization that no one on earth has ever hurt us, and no one on earth has ever helped us. Every hurt that has ever come into our experience has been the direct result of our inability to behold this universe as spiritual. Which means, when we are hurt, if we accept that we were meant to be hurt, and the instrument through whom the hurt happens is irrelevant, then that is just hurt in the moment, without a story created around it. And that is why, I'm not sure if I mentioned it in the last talk, Joel Goldsmith says something so beautiful on prayer, that how can one just pray for one's loved ones and one's friends? Isn't that a selfish prayer? If everyone is God's child, an instrument of God, the divine, by praying for yourself and your loved ones, you've already created the split the separation from source. Then pray for your enemies too, because they are equally representations of that consciousness. This is very hard for us. To even think like that is very hard for us. And this master said it so beautifully in one of his books, another of his books. He says that I accept all there is God, all there is consciousness, and so on and so forth. And I accept that even the enemies are part of that. But I could not bring myself to love my enemies. That was next to impossible. I accept it. I understand, I accept what had to happen, happened. And then he said, in a moment of contemplation, he said, I sat back and in my dialogue with God, I said, look here. I accept that this had to happen. They were the instruments of the happening. But I cannot love them. And therefore, all I ask is that you love them through me. So it's not my responsibility anymore. You love them through me. I can't do it. So beautiful. Where I stand on is holy ground. When I contemplate the presence of God, which means the conscious presence here and now in this moment. Nisargadatta Maharaj is abide in your being, I am. Ramana Maharshi, in one book I read, he says, don't focus on what is seen, but on that which sees. Conscious presence here and now. Consciousness. As Maharaj says, don't make use of consciousness, but be established as consciousness. Available, present, which happens when the thinking mind of the ego is disengaged. And this entire beautiful teaching brings about the disengagement of the thinking mind. That is the beauty of it. Your job is being done by the teaching. When you find, thanks to the teaching, you're carrying a lesser load of ill will, spite, jealousy, envy, blame, condemnation, guilt, shame, and so on and so forth. The thinking mind is being disengaged. All this garbage is being let go of. And when that happens, one is more and more in the present moment as conscious presence available for what is. Not what should be, or what should have been. All right. If anyone would like to share anything or ask anything, then we can take these questions now. Yes, Holger.
Hello, Gautam.
Hello.
Good to see you.
Thank you, you too.
Every time you look a little bit different.
For better, I hope.
Yes. A friend of mine, a Zoom friend of mine, has this habit of saying everything is as it is. And for some reason, it just doesn't sit well with me. It doesn't feel authentic. It feels more like a cop out or something. Mm-hmm. And I have this idea everything is as it is according to my point of view. Can you say something about this?
Well, everything is as it is. Really cannot be according to a point of view. If one is living, everything is as it is, then there's a total acceptance of what is. It's, if it's an intellectual acceptance, only that person will know who says everything is as it is and whether he or she is at peace or not. You see? Because if I say everything is as it is and inside I'm not at peace and I'm burning up or there's a lot of angst, then obviously it's just words which are coming out of my mouth. But if it is a lived experience, that everything is as it is means as it has presented itself, which I may like or I may not like. But the sheer fact it has come into my awareness, into consciousness, the happening has happened, means it is. Otherwise, it wouldn't be. Now, if that is my way of living, then I'm at peace. And only that person would know whether these are just empty words or it is truly the way they are living.
Thank you. It's already late for me and I'm rather tired.
Yes.
But I really appreciate seeing you, and there's lots of gratitude here.
Thank you, Holger.
And yeah, there are flip-flops. Today was a very strong flip-flop for me. I was just out doing errands, driving around, going into big shopping centers. In the beginning, everything was beautiful. Everything was very easy. But then somehow it just got too much, and I still had to finish certain things. This was an interesting experience because I realized how, in what a protective kind of bubble I seem to live. I mean, I surround myself with satsang recordings, with beautiful teachings from Ramesh and Roger and from you and other people. And I'm wondering, am I just living in a bubble?
Not really, Holger, because actually the flip-flop is a part of this process. It is a very natural... You see, when one is introduced to a new concept, a new dimension of living, you know, the old conditioning keeps fighting it also. So the flip-flop is sometimes I'm at peace, sometimes I'm not. Sometimes I see the world this way now, with the way it's been exposed to me, which was not earlier. Sometimes it goes out of the window. That is the flip-flop. But the main point is that in this duration, is one finding that one has had larger periods of peace than prior to the teaching or not? That is the main point, that although there may be these flip-flops, is there by and large some more depth in the peace that I feel in life, or is it completely unchanged and as it was prior to being exposed to the teaching? This is a question one has to ask. I'm reminded of this girl who was was deeply impacted by The Power of Now by Eckhart Tolle. And she was studying and reading that book for, I think, over 12 years. And her question was, she said that one day I had a fight with my boyfriend in the car, and I got out of the car and I slammed the door shut. And in that one instance, I felt, where did the 12 years go? You see? Now, the point is the 12 years didn't go anywhere. We never know what happens the next moment. Sometimes pleasure, sometimes pain. What the triggers were, what the boyfriend said, or was something else which happened a week ago in her mind, a day ago, maybe got some reports of some medical test or a friend something, etc., etc., etc. In that moment, the car door was slammed shut. But then this correlation, therefore, what happens to those 12 years of reading The Power of Now? It is not about the correlation. A happening happens. This happened. In spite of your best intentions and those 12 years, this happened. Now the point is, does the ego create a story around this happening? That this car door should not have got slammed by me. If it has happened, it means the teaching has not gone deep enough. And this is what the ego loves, you see. Whereas the event is gone. The event is gone. And if seen in the light of understanding, she calls up her boyfriend and says, I'm really sorry for what happened. It was not intended. And the matter is settled there. But the ego now wants to say, my God, I didn't grasp this teaching enough. Maybe I'm living in a bubble, maybe this, maybe that. That is the doubting mind, you see. That is what happens. And therefore, I say, by and large, if you feel that life has become simpler, then one has to stay with that. Then the rest is just the ego making all these stories up. That's the way it is. I don't know.
Yes, I see the ego, and I must admit that the teaching really has some profound impact
on me. You know, I'm reminded of something else. This is going back about 20 years, Holger. It's on Eckhart, actually, when he had come to Mumbai in the year 2002 or 2001, I'm not sure. I don't remember. So we had a two-day afternoon event. And the first day was a sellout. And this is when he came, I think we had not even sold 500 copies of The Power of Now in India. And somehow by word of mouth or whatever, by destiny, whatever you call it, the event was advertised and the auditorium was full. I mean, full to capacity. Now, what happened was, that day, the newspapers announced that the next day, what we call locally would be a bandh, which means a strike, a total strike. So the trains would not work, the buses would not work, the taxis would not work, and so on and so forth. And I felt so bad because I felt, you know, I mean, this is his first trip to India. And all this effort, all this work has been done. The first day has gone so well. And so we met at the end of the first day. We were sitting and I explained to him this concept of this strike which has happened in Bombay and that people may not show up, you see, which was what I was feeling so bad about. And two things, you know. He said in his gentle voice, he said, even if one person shows up, I don't mind. And two, let's see how many show up. You see? So, and the next day, I think about half of those who came for the first day did come. I don't know how, but they came. Obviously, they were so drawn to him and his teaching that they landed up. But the point is, that this flip-flop, which I was going through, you know, will people come? Will they not come? All the mechanics of the mind creating these stories that, you know, we've organized this, we've put in so much effort, this, that, that. And when I saw this ease and complete surrender and acceptance to what is as it is, it was for me very beautiful to see, you see. And then that is when I recall my teacher's words. He said, awakening is like being given the driving license. But still, you just learn to drive, you see. And you get nervous. You're going through heavy traffic. You're driving slow. You know, we have like on our cars, we have to put the alphabet L as learner. And so it really agitates people who are behind because they start blowing their horns, thinking this guy is too slow and all that. But as Rameshji says, you know, a year goes by, 2 years go by, and it's at the end of 2 years that one day you're driving and you feel, my God, 2 years ago when I got the license, I used to be quite nervous driving through this very street, and now I realize I'm so relaxed. And so that is that period between getting the license and this realization is the flip-flop period. At first, one didn't even know how to drive. Now the teaching has come in, given you the gears and shown you things, but that's a process in time.
Wonderful. Thank you.
I've kept you up. Thank you. Thank you. Okay. Is there anyone else who would like to ask a question? If not, we can just sit in silence. Yes, there's... Yes, Priyam. Are you there?
Good morning, sir.
Yes. How is your art going?
It's going good, thank you. My question is, if after doing bare minimum things for survival and just to have a comfortable life, after that, if you do not feel the impulse to do anything more, is that being passive towards life? Is that being lazy? It's like sometimes I feel like I'm just sitting on a chair and looking at other people play and other people participate and other people get excited about things. But I feel like once I'm done with the basic tasks of the day, once I've paid the bills and everything, there is no excitement or to do something else and to experience something else. So is that being disrespectful to God and all the resources the universe has given to you, all the gifts? Is that being like you're taking so much and not giving back enough? Because sometimes people can say something like, you have all these gifts and resources and you can inspire other people, you can inspire other girls, other women. There is so much you can give back. But what if you do not feel like the need to really do anything once your basic survival needs are met? So I just was questioning whether it's just like an escapist attitude. It's just coming out of being passive, or... I mean, I'm just conflicted. Is it like what's coming naturally to me right now, or is it just not wanting to participate in life and not wanting to experience things?
Well, Priyam, you are actually one of the fortunate few in that case, because everyone is so driven otherwise. And if you are happy and content with what you have, isn't that a great gift? If you are not one to make more demands on God, and you're content with the little you get or whatever it is you get, it is a most beautiful space to be in. And
what about the thoughts that you're not giving back to the universe and inspiring people?
No, is that something you would like to do? Then do it. If it is not your nature to do it, don't do it. You see, then all these issues of guilt come up. People say, oh, how can you do this? You're so young. You can just sit back and do this. It's not correct, blah, 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 blah. Point is, what do you feel and what is your nature to do? If one's nature is not to get too embroiled in life, that needs to be honored. You see, but this constant being on a treadmill of life, all the time running around, running, going here, going there, that is why Maharaj said, it is not what you do, but what you stop doing that matters. You see, we are doing so much, which is not our nature, which is pure conditioning, hardwired by society. I'll tell you something quite funny. I might make a video on my anecdotes on Marine Drive, which is outside my house, this promenade by the sea. And the other day I went for a walk, morning walk, and I met a friend. I hadn't seen her for a long time. So she said, let's walk together. Now, she was walking so fast that I was getting very tired, but I said, I must keep pace with her, you know. And in my mind, I'm thinking that I'm not walking with her again. And I know why she's walking fast, because she's super fit. Her husband was a cop. So, you know, all that. And it's like being in the police force. And I'm like, it's exhausting me. So it reached a point where I said, look, I'm going to turn around now. And, you know, if you don't mind. She said, actually, even I was going to tell you that, because I can't keep pace with you. I said, excuse me, I was trying to keep pace with you. We were both trying to keep pace with each other, thinking it's the other who was walking fast, you see. That is what happens in life. We try to keep pace with society, what people think should be our pace. When we rest in our being, in the isness of what is, and our nature, as God made it, naturally, which comes to us, that which comes to us naturally, without some forced imposition of others' conditioning, others' viewpoints. When one operates from that space, one is living in the natural flow of life. In that natural flow of life, if at some point Priyam feels that, oh, now I've had enough of resting and being, you know, present to what is, now I feel I have the energy to kind of start something or give back, etc., then that is honored, because now there's no position taken that this is how I must be now. Priyam is now available to whatever the next moment may bring. That is what it is. That is what happens. Okay?
Okay, thank you, sir.
Thank you. Yes, Kumar.
Namaste, Gautam, sir.
Namaste, namaste.
So I had a question. Is rebelling against the societal conditionings and stereotypes spiritually useful? I remember I saw kids playing 2 days ago, like 4 or 5 year olds. And I started getting on the slides and swings, considering my height and my age, and they're all people staring, but I still did it for 2 hours and it felt like a great release. So is going beyond the people's perception and sometimes behaving weird according to the society be spiritually liberating in a way?
I think it's a great thing for you, because you're free of those bonds, you see. The spontaneity of the moment, the joy of being a child again. You were not held back by what society would say. I think it's a great space to be in, as long as you didn't damage any property because of your size. But that's it, you know, Kubar. The thing is that these influences operate less and less on us, and therefore we could be perceived as not being normal. But normal by whose standards? By God's standards, or by a structured way of conditioned collective thinking? That is why you find many artists, many people who are creative are so-called not perceived as normal. They are perceived as eccentric, because they honor what is and they honor their nature. So they end up being on the fringes of society, which wants people to be and behave a certain way. But it's beautiful. I mean, what you have shared, it must have been so exhilarating to be on that slide or whatever it is you did. It's so lovely to be a child again. You see, this is what the teaching actually does, Kumar. One's thinking becomes simpler and childlike. One starts actually really seeing the through innocent eyes, you know. It's this whole dimension of the spiritual life, spiritual living, which Joel Goldsmith calls the fourth dimensional way of living. is truly childlike, not childish, childlike. Because that baggage which the ego has acquired since growing up and during and through growing up, that is what is getting dropped off. And it's really, you will be surprised, there are so many sages, and I have met many who are now quite old, but they have this beautiful childlike quality to them, the way they laugh, the way they, you know, just the way they are. And it's a real joy to see that. Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
So go back to that swing and that slide soon. Yes, James. Yeah, James, are you there?
Namaste, Gautam. Thank you for Namaste. Being here this evening.
Namaste.
Gautam, I'm struggling with this lack of, or this belief that God is also evil. It's just so hard for me to accept that God is racism and God is oppression and God is supporting some of the horrible things that I see happening to people. That just really, that's just so not my belief that God would be so, when I see so many things that are so just gut-wrenching, horrible, and also my belief that, you know, when these things exist, I feel like having had so many powerful experiences, or not, but some experiences of God's love and God's feelings of God, that it's not somehow my responsibility to stand up against that.
Yes.
And to believe that it is evil. And it's just so hard for me to accept that evil is God. I mean, I just have that just is something that's, I mean, I do believe that God permeates the universe, but somehow we have this dharma to do something about these things that.
Sure. Absolutely. So, James, there's a slight error which I would like to rectify here. You know, about God is being evil. God is not being evil. You see, God is all there is, and good and evil are the polaric ends, just as left and right, up and down, front and back. So, you see, when we say God is evil, that's not what this teaching is saying. What this teaching is saying is duality is the duality of opposites of every conceivable kind, which are within the source, one, right? So it does not mean that one is in this case evil and that one is in this case good, because then that is already a split. What this teaching is saying is that what we perceive as evil, as my teacher would say, let's say on one end of the spectrum, we have a Mother Teresa, or anyone you look up to, could be Jesus or whatever, and on the other end we have a Hitler. The fact is both happened. The fact is that both incarnated on this earth, right? As instruments through whom things happened. So there's no power beyond that one source which was responsible for creating the Hitler. The source is the same, which includes extreme polarities. In this case was a Hitler on one side, and in the other case it was a Jesus or a Buddha or whatever, right? Now what it is saying is that both exist, they both came into being because it was the will of the source. There is no power greater than the source. Thereafter, doing something about it, as you say, it reached a point, as far as Hitler was concerned, where countries had to wake up and see what was happening and then act against Hitler. It doesn't mean that, you know, the US also became complacent, etc. and etc. Consciousness had to reach a point where it realized and it decided collectively things were going beyond control. They had been for a long time. And at that inflection point, a decision was taken. as you said, dharma, a dharmic decision was taken that this has to be put an end to, which was also a functioning of the same source, the same consciousness. So this play of duality, this play in our own lives of good and evil, it does not mean that God is becoming good and God is also evil. It is the play of duality. This is the structure of duality. And as I say, as my teacher would say, healthy children on one side, handicapped children on one side. So we can't say that, oh, you know, how could God create handicapped children? Then God can ask, nobody asked me why I create healthy children. This is the concept of duality, to explain that the structure of life and living is polaric opposites of every conceivable kind. And so when someone like Joel Goldsmith says that there's no such thing as evil, what he's trying to say is that it's all from the same source, one power, which is omnipresent, omnipotent, through which the game of life is played. So it certainly does not mean that we allow things to happen. It certainly does not mean that. We do precisely that which we think and feel we should do, which is adharma. If we perceive something wrong has happened, racism, as you say, it doesn't mean that, oh, this is meant to happen, so we don't do anything about it. It is ghastly. Racism is ghastly. We have seen it in India when in the British times, outside the clubs, they would put up placards saying Indians and dogs not allowed. You see? But what this teaching is pointing at is that when you accept that this has happened, in our case, we got taken over by the British. And thereafter, freedom movement arose because this was not right. And Gandhi then came up and led the freedom movement. That too was a happening from the same source. So then this is how life and living transforms to dealing with what arises, whether we like it or not. But we accept this is the play of consciousness. You see? And then the right decisions are taken. The right moves are made, so to speak, because you are approaching this situation more objectively. Not because you are invested with hate and malice and pointing your guns at others because they are doing wrong things. You see, because then you're playing the same game. So the teaching brings about an objectivity into the equation which was not there earlier. So there is a difference, because we are still thinking in terms of the split mind. If we say that God is, I can't believe God is evil and God is this and God is that. God is all there is. Now let's look at what we consider acts of evil and what we feel we should do about it. So it does not say not to do all that. Otherwise, India would not have been a free country if we just sat back and said, let it be, it is God's will, you see. It's the same.
Is there the possibility, I know if it's all God, it's all God, but is it possible that through this conflict of these two opposites, that at some point that'll evolve to something greater?
Well, in a sense, yes, because that is why in our scriptures we have the yugas, the various cycles of time, and what is referred to as Sat Yug, the age of truth. There's the Kal Yug, there's the Sat Yug. So it is a wheel of time. You see, when there's a enlightened living on a large scale, that is when we'll be living in the age of truth. When we will be so-called on a collective scale living beyond what we today see as this dimension of living, that we are stuck between these polaric opposites. But the nature of duality will not change, because life is duality. What changes is our perception and our attitude to it. That is what happens.
And when is this age coming?
Long way off.
Seemingly so.
I'll tell you something very funny and then we can end on that note. You know, I had gone to one antique market in Bombay, and this is something you may not be familiar, many may not be familiar with it. In India, we have the 10 incarnations of Lord Vishnu, who's the preserver. And his latest incarnation was the Buddha, and before that was Krishna and Lord Ram and so on. So I went into this antique shop and I saw a most beautiful, looked very antique statue of a, it was a white marble statue of a being, a very powerful being riding a horse. And I felt very drawn to it. And so I was with a very learned friend of mine and the shopkeeper was there. And I asked the shopkeeper, who is this? Whose statue is this? And he said, this is the statue of Kalki. Now, Kalki is the 10th incarnation of Vishnu that has still not appeared on earth. So he's the last, the 10th and last incarnation that is left to arrive, so to speak. The Buddha was the 9th. So I said, oh, I love this statue and I want to buy it. And my friend stopped me. He said, please don't. So I said, why? He said, because to invite Kalki means first the world has to become so destructive, so terrible, then only will he come. So first you'll have to invite all destruction into your life and then Kalki will come. So if you're getting Kalki, you're getting all that destruction before that. So please don't get Kalki. I don't want any more drama in my life, and I left it there at that shop. So when the human dilemma, the human greed, the human conflict reaches a boiling point, that is when the divine, at least in our scriptures, comes in as an avatar to settle the score and balance things out. So the Satyug is, I think, still far off, but you know, as Maharaj would say, if everyone finds the peace within themselves and abides in their being, you needn't be concerned with the world outside. And as Joel Goldsmith would say, that whatever you see outside is a projection of what is inside, what is within your consciousness. And he gave the most beautiful example of the fruits on trees. He said, if no one taught you or educated you and you saw a tree with fruit hanging, you would perhaps not be able to comprehend that the fruit actually is produced from within the tree. You would think, my God, what are these things attached to the branches of the tree? And so he gave the example of abundance coming from within and being like within the tree and abundant fruit being produced. And so he would tell his seekers that your abundance lies within your own being, your own consciousness. But when you look at the outside world and think it can give you abundance, that is the error. You think you want to add things to you, but the abundance is a state of being, just like the tree. So when our focus, so to speak, is within ourselves, the kingdom of God is within. If everyone was to follow that path, it is natural that there would not be conflict, abuse, racism, etc. anymore. Because as within, so without. That is the Satyug. Okay. We'll just for a couple of minutes in silence. I'll just change the view so I can see everyone. When you think life is being hard on you, a lot of things are going wrong. Think of Saint Teresa. She was one day in the field working very hard pushing wheelbarrows around in wet soil and so on and so forth, and got extremely tired and fatigued. And she cried out to Jesus. And she said, "Oh Jesus, why are you making it so hard for me?" And Jesus replied and said, "Don't worry. I only ask this from my close friends." And she said, "No wonder you don't have many close friends." Challenges are bound to come our way. That is what the journey is about. Our attitude to life, the way we see events that transpire, viewing them from this spiritual dimension, as Goldsmith says, rather than any old conditioned way of reacting.